Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. You ought to consider advertising on the show. Here's how it'll work. You give me money, and then I'll tell everybody how great your stuff is, they'll buy it, and we'll all be rich as Republicans. Sound pretty good? Shoot me an email, scott@scotthorton.org, and we'll work it out. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is the Scott Horton Show. You can find my full archives at scotthorton.org. More than 2,700 interviews now going back to 2003. And you find my whole show archives there as well. It's Jeffrey Tucker from Laissez-Faire Books. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Let's do this thing, Mr. Scott. It's an impressive archive, I hear.
Well, yeah, and you know what? It all started with the Iraq War. Well, the interview part of the show. I did radio before that, but the interview show started right at the dawn of the Iraq War. My first interview, which people, I'll probably end up playing it on the anniversary of it, is April 9th, 2003, and I interviewed the great Alan Bach from Antiwar.com's Eye on the Empire column, and, of course, the Orange County Register, and wrote the great book on Ruby Ridge and Medical Pot and all that, the late, great Alan Bach. And what's funny is if you go back and listen to that interview, especially him, but me too, we're both completely right about everything. About all of the lies and how we got into it and who was responsible and what's going to happen next to a terrifying degree. And
I'm glad to hear the story of how you developed your pathology, your very strange and perverse obsession with this idea of, you know, like peace and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, for some reason, it kind of stands out as unique. I'm not sure why, but anyway, it is what it is. No, I mean, I guess I am sure why, because I grew up in America, and war is fun, and I'm a boy, and so I like watching explosions and stuff, and if they let me fly an F-16, hell, I might kill people. If I thought I really had a chance of flying an F-16, maybe, you know? At least there'd be a percent chance. Okay, not really, but I can understand that way of thinking anyway. I know that's how people think. And we got breakfast the other morning, and the sign said, "We thank the troops who serve for our freedom." And it's like a religious catechism or whatever the hell. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. You know, it's just a thing people believe.
Yeah, I never really understand. I really can't understand. Although, you know, I must tell you that there was a time, and it was a long time ago, that I was kind of into the whole Cold War thing, and I imagined, you know, that the nation state was sort of an extension of my own, you know, sort of teen manliness or something like that. And, you know, when Reagan would invade a country, I'd sort of think, yeah, let's get the bad guys. And then I had a long talk with a guy who was actually in the Marines, and he told me what it was actually like. And it was a terrifying discussion. And that snapped me of that sort of psychology of nationalism. And I never went back.
Yeah, there you go. That happened to me, too, as a young kid. And I think pretty much everybody, if they remember back, they've met an Army guy who told them, yeah, man, I was deployed in countries that you've never heard of, killing people and stuff like that. That is scandalous stuff, man. Secret stuff. That. And there's so many people who actually have participated in that kind of thing, right? How many tens of thousands of special forces guys are there, former special forces guys are there around. Everybody knows somebody who did some dark, terrible thing for Uncle Sam, you know?
Yeah, and they suffered for it, too. I mean, my friend's story, to me, the one that, like, gripped me, and I just can't even forget it, was, in fact, I just talked to him yesterday on the phone. It was the first time in probably 25 years I talked to the guy. I should have brought this up to him. But anyway, he told me about, I was going, you know, we should go into Nicaragua and just beat up those commies, you know. They said, yeah, I kind of see the attraction of that. You know, the big problem, though, is fungus. I said, what are you talking about, fungus? And he said, well, it's weird. It's like you're going through and, they issue these boots. They're not so clean. And then you get, like, athlete's foot. And then you have to sort of go through rivers and walk around. And then the athlete's foot sort of crawls up your legs. And it spreads to between your legs. And then pretty soon it's on your chest. It's under your armpits. And you get a whole body full of fungus. And, like, nobody's got anything to fix it. And it just gets worse every day. You keep having to put on the same clothes. And pretty soon your whole body's just kind of itchy and flaky and red. And it's pretty damn miserable. And, you know, he said this to me, like, my jaw hit the floor. I thought, God, that's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. Maybe it sounds like a trivial point, but it sounded absolutely terrifying to me. And somehow it brought the reality of, like, how crappy, you know, life is as a soldier. I thought, how can I, you know, be urging this on anybody?
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, George Carlin, when I was a kid, George Carlin put it, talking about George H.W. Bush and how people had called him a wimp, and wimp rhymes with limp, and so that's not manly at all. So he had to send other people's children to die. And the way Carlin put it, like, that was the punchline, and it wasn't very funny. It was just straight to the point. You know, that was how he made up for being such a, you know, not a Ronald Reagan-esque, you know, strident Hollywood actor, warrior guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think really there's an element of unreality about warmongerism. You know, they really can't look at the truth. That's why all the technology, you know, is leaning more and more towards, you know, higher, you know, people flying, you know, not people on the ground so much, but people flying way over. You know, you can watch those videos from Iraq. You can see how it's like a big video game. You know, if you can depersonalize war and make the people doing the killing as distant as possible from the actual blood and suffering and the human beings, then it's actually more successful, probably.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. There's a whole thing about that. Actually never read the book, but one time I was a cab driver and the guy riding, we were stuck in the worst rainstorm traffic in Austin ever or something, driving all the way across town, and he told me all about the book on killing, and it was about how back during the Civil War they would find, of you know, the dead soldiers on the battlefield, a lot of them, their musket would just be, or their rifle would just be full of shot, and they would not really shoot because they just couldn't bear to kill another man like that, even when they're on the line fighting like that, and they could hide behind all the smoke and you couldn't really tell who was shooting and who wasn't, that kind of thing. And how the U.S. military has made its hardest science this whole time. How do you take a good kid out of a church pew and put a rifle in his hand and turn him into a psychopathic killer of civilians? And they've been working on it, and they come up with all kinds of routines, and part of it is just making you and your five best friends blood brothers and making everything just about protecting each other, where the nature of the mission and what country you're in and all those things have nothing to do with it at all.
Yeah, it disappears, you know? Right.
And then, of course, distance has a lot to do with it, like you're saying, too. Shooting artillery over the hill versus bayoneting somebody, you know, it's a lot easier to do it that way, or from the air, something like that.
Did you get a chance to see the new Lincoln movie?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, so it's got some scenes in there that really bring home the sort of grim horrors of war and unusual scenes, right? Because I expected kind of pure hagiography. But actually, remember the scene where they're dumping the limbs out of the wheelbarrow into the pit?
Yeah.
And then that other time when I think Lincoln himself is touring the battlefields and it's just bodies stacked, you know, everywhere. And that combined with the sort of the detailed accounting of how he tried to keep his kid out of the war.
Yeah, yeah, and... Yeah, yeah, I thought that was great that they, you know, bothered to portray that part. And then they have him saying actually to the general, to General Grant, that you and I have enabled each other to do terrible things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing. There's enough in the movie, actually, especially if you have some background. There's enough in the movie to actually, you know, drive home the anti-war point.
Yeah.
I thought, anyway. That was my takeaway.
You know what? Speaking of which, the great, it's Bill Kaufman, right? The front porch Republican? He's got a movie coming out called Copperhead, which is all about New York peaceniks during the Civil War. I'll send you the link. Angela Keaton sent me the link to the preview on Yahoo.com. It's awesome.
Oh, wow. So
it's unbelievably
really
awesome.
Isn't it so fabulous how digital media is making, you know, the digital economy is giving life to all these new forms of art? In the old days, you had to write books, now I can make movies. I mean, it's so great, isn't it? I mean, you notice that popular culture is sort of weirdly getting better, the more competitive, the more people that are entering into media creation and movie making and book writing and distribution of films. It's all sort of getting better. I mean, I love it, a ton of the new stuff on television, you know, from Breaking Bad to... The Boardwalk Empire, and, you know, all these sort of cool things that are showing essentially the history of rebel culture, you know? It's great.
Yeah, I mean, even the formerly centralized avenues of communication, they all have to accept feedback in numerous ways now. Their comment sections and their personal Twitter feeds that they maintain and whatever, and there's just a lot of pushback and different, you know, I talked with Greg Mitchell from Editor and Publisher, the great chronicler of the media and the Iraq War, and we talked about how there was no accountability for the guilty in media who went along with the nonsense that got us into that war, and yet the real truth is the accountability has been completely served up by their audience, which has abandoned them in droves and instead goes to the internet and looks at least for independent and alternative confirmation of whatever narrative the government is trying to push. And they really created a lot of distrust. And they really, you know, Newsweek no longer even prints. They're just the Daily Beast now, Jeff.
Have you done any coverage of the Zero Dark Thirty movie? What's the story with that? You probably have. You've probably done 10 shows on it. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit behind.
You know, I don't know if I've interviewed anybody about it. I had some remarks about it before, sure, which are basically it's a propaganda film saying that no torture, no bin Laden. We never would have got him without torture, which is, in fact, not true, verified by even the likes of Dianne Feinstein and by the great Ali Soufan, who was the FBI agent who got the information personally by asking nicely rather than beating it out of him. It was the CIA who came later and beat other things out of the guy. But so it wasn't even true. And then the other message, of course, was targeted killings, too, that we would never raid a house and kill people when there could be women and children there unless the president personally gave the thumbs down on their ass and unless the nice lady with red hair is 100% sure that the bad guy is there, which is a total lie, of course. They kill people with their drones and their jets all day. I'm sorry?
Did you see the film?
Well, I didn't pay money, but I got it off the Pirate Bay, you'll be happy to know.
Okay.
I got the torrent file.
Breaking Bad. Yeah. So did it drive you crazy? I mean, was it just annoying from beginning to end?
Yeah, well, and part of it, too, was it was just really bad acting and bad directing and everything, too. Everybody was talking about, well, you know, the cinematography was supposed to look all fancy like that movie Traffic or whatever, but it didn't impress me at all. And then the dialogue was absolutely wooden. I mean, here they're completely torturing it out of this guy. And instead of saying, you know, talk, MF-er, they're saying, tell me everything that you know. Or what? You know what I mean? Where you're just like, what? Like, he couldn't even. The Discovery Channel did the exact same movie, and it was way better. You know, I hate to say it. But they had their own version, and it was just much better.
I had the opportunity to see it, and instead I chose Oz the Great and Powerful, which is a wonderful libertarian film. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it yet, but, you know, so like this guy just sort of shows up at Oz, and then there's these witches that are fighting with each other, and then the good witch wants to enlist him in a battle against the bad witches. So he assumes that, well, he's got to raise up an army. So he goes to the townspeople. And he says, all right, so who here knows a lot about sort of soldiering and has guns? And they all say, well, actually, we're not really into that sort of killing stuff. So we don't have any soldiers here. We're just like farmers and tinkerers, which is a great word. Tinkerers, they'd be like making machines and stuff. And we sew stuff. And they're just the bourgeoisie. So he's like, oh, crap, now we're doomed, right? Now the butchers are definitely going to get us. But then he has another thought. He thinks, well, why don't I enlist these people in sort of a division of labor and create a sort of market-based illusion to just scare these horrible witches? And that's essentially what happens. So Oz is saved through, you know, not through warfare and guns and battles and death, but through the bourgeoisie coming together through the division of labor to create cool contraptions.
Yeah, that is cool. No, I haven't got a chance to see that one yet. That's fun.
It's like you're going to find more truth in kids' movies than adult movies anyway. I always believe that.
Yeah, well, it's those simple lessons that everybody teaches kids, like, hey, don't hit and be nice and stuff like that, that are the libertarian principles. All the other ideologies are really just fancy excuses for violating those simple principles, you know?
Yeah. It's the adult movies that are really childish and the kids' movies that are really, you know, speak the adult truths. I've felt that way for a long time. I love kids' movies. I love to go through them. I always leave delighted, you know, and happy. But it's something like Zero Dark, whatever, 30, whatever. It's not the way I want to spend 2 hours. So I kind of feel bad. I feel like I should be watching movies like that so I can criticize them or something, but I just can't bring myself to do it.
Yeah, nah, don't bother, man. Focus on the good. You do a good job of that for sure.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah. And by the way, speaking of which, I sent you an article by some guy, I don't know, this is a few months back, about how, look out, but this is actually the golden age of mankind. And you wouldn't believe what all's going on out there in the world. And there's another one that's sort of along those lines. It's not quite as utopian about it, but it's at McClatchy, and it's called UN Predicts Huge Expansion of Wealth in Developing World That Will Shift Power, which I'm not so much interested in that part. But it's just about how, you know, basically peace and more or less property rights are reigning across the world. And yes, even socialist, educational, and medicinal institutions. But in many of these places, their governments literally are the only ones with enough capital to even take on such projects, at least for now. But still, it amounts to a huge leap forward from where they were. And otherwise, they have basically, you know, trade and property rights and peace reigning from, you know, Morocco and all the way around again, you know?
Yeah, it's a glorious thing. I mean, you know, the market economy it's going to save civilization, and, you know, God willing, someday we'll displace this the horrible war machines that are still persistent in the world. But, you know, I think we're seeing a kind of long-run trend. I was just writing an article just now for the Freeman. It was commissioned by Max over there on Bitcoin. And I kind of began it by saying, if 30 years ago somebody came up to you and said, you know, in the future, we're going to be sending little digital texts to each other, to our little private inboxes, that we can open at our leisure, and it's going to completely replace first-class mail, you would have said, well, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. I mean, after all, not even the Jetsons imagined such a thing as email. And yet, it's happened, right? And, yeah, I mean, you can look at it, you know, in so many areas, and now, you know, you see email being, you know, increasingly replaced by texting and private messaging on Facebook and voice messaging over Skype, like voice over internet protocols, and all these sort of new communications technologies that nobody even imagined would exist. There's never been any headlines. You know, it just happens, and it's a beautiful thing to see this new world emerging.
Yeah, I'm looking at Bitcoins, and I'm thinking, you know, I used to think, oh, my God, the cashless society is the New World Order plot to enslave us all with a microchip in our hand and track everything we buy and sell, and we're all going to die. And this is a long time ago. I haven't been quite that bad of a kook in a while. But anyway, here we actually have, like, real cashlessness, and it's all encrypted and anonymous, and you can't do nothing about it, Big Brother, and how do you like that?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, and it keeps getting these boosts. Every time government, like, flops again, people are racing to Bitcoin more and more. I was looking at some of the history of this whole thing, and you know, people had dreamed about a digital currency all the way back in the 1990s, and there were four or five, you know, within the geek community anyway, high-profile attempts, but they could never solve the key problem, which was the simultaneous use of the same piece of property, which is the problem with the monetary system, right? So, like, with the gold standard, all gold is interchangeable with all other gold. It's fungible in that way. But when you're holding an ounce of gold, nobody else can simultaneously be holding that. So you have a real title to the money. And it's a problem in the digital world because, you know, digits specialize in reproducibility. So every one of these previous attempts to create a digital currency faltered on this. Nobody could really figure this out until this one anonymous, you know, Japanese guy, Satoshi Nakamoto, it's not his real name, but he came up with a great system where that every time a user would use the Bitcoin, he would download the entire ledger and be able to check to make sure that the property titles were properly assigned. So that solved the problem of reproducibility and simultaneous use. And so you would have just one title to one Bitcoin, and it would only be used, you know, held in the possession of one person at a time. And so that overcame the thing that had sort of prevented previous digital currencies from taking off. Did you know that history?
No, I did not know that history. And
yeah,
I did read a thing, and this is always immediately my question, is, well, who gets to invent the new ones? Who gets to benefit and buy a brand new truck just because they get to, you know, come up with the newest Bitcoins that come out every day or whatever? And apparently they even solve that with this mining thing, which I don't really understand,
yeah,
but...
That's a funny thing because, like, Bitcoin couldn't exist were it not for the experience of the gold standard. And then all the whole open source computer model, algorithmic model of Bitcoins is based on a sort of historical experience of the gold standard. So, and the gold standard, you can't create new money unless you expend resources to do it. So you have to go out and you have to mine it, and you're having to spend money, and you dig it up, it's a lot of work, and then they come online. And so he decided to reproduce that same sort of system of gold mining, except in a digital sense, by having computers solve complex math problems. And he makes it, it's built into the structure of Bitcoin that it gets increasingly difficult to mine over time. And there's an upward limit on the number that can be mined, just as there's an upward limit on the amount of gold, in the world. And we're not going to reach that for another 1,500 years or whatever, but nonetheless, it gets increasingly difficult. So you have to dig deeper and deeper into the mountain to get the gold. It's the same way with Bitcoins. You have to solve ever more, math problems. I met a really cool miner a couple months ago, and he was just a classic figure. You know, very quiet. He's from China. His English was not that good. He had big, thick glasses, and he just sort of was in deep contemplation all the time. And he built a system of racks of servers that were mining pretty quickly, fast enough to be at that time earning minimum wage. He's gotten a raise since that time. But typically, there's a new Bitcoin coming online about every 10 minutes. But even now, there's a kind of shortage, so to speak, because it's not so easy to get Bitcoins. The services that you can buy them from have to limit the amount that you can buy per day because they would, you know, quickly run out.
Yeah, there's not an endless number of sellers for the amount of demand, in other words.
Yeah, people are holding on to them, which is why Krugman hates it. He had a very funny column. He said, you know what the problem with Bitcoin is? It's too much like a gold standard. You're just like in the gold standard, people are like hoarding money, and that's bad because we need money, you know, to be spent and circulating all the time because he's like a Keynesian inflationist. So his problem with Bitcoin is precisely its soundness. There's a really very funny column.
I mean,
there's a ringing endorsement.
Yeah. Well, I cashed all mine in. I started taking donations in Bitcoins last summer. They were worth about 10 bucks, and then I had a problem with my program. I couldn't get it to work, and I didn't know where the correct wallet file was in the app data folder, whatever the hell. And so I couldn't make it work for a long time. And when I finally figured out, with the help of some Facebook friends, how to make it work again, I had even more Bitcoin donations that I didn't even know about. And then lo and behold, they were worth 45 bucks, something like that. So I cashed them in so I could hire a dentist to yank my wisdom tooth out for me. And then now I realize if I'd held on to them just a few more days, it would have been worth about 500 bucks more. And it seems almost like tulip mania, something like that. I wonder what you think of that.
Yeah, it sometimes seems that way, but the thing is, it doesn't actually make sense. I mean, people kind of dismiss it as being a bubble, but the fact is we're seeing, you know, vast increasing demand. I mean, what I wanted to say was, you know, the first Bitcoin came online like November 1st, 2008, and I don't remember at the time, but like the entire political financial establishment was in a freakout mode, right? So like housing prices had collapsed and the banks, you know, were suddenly holding all these, they were desperately trying to dump their mortgage-backed securities, and everything was going sort of going belly up. I mean, you know, boats were stuck in the harbors because they couldn't get, you know, bonds to ship their goods, and yeah, the whole world was freaking out, and of course, George Bush is like president or something. And he had this great idea that he would, you know, marshal all resources in existence and create those that aren't in existence to rescue everything and fill the banks back up with the coffers to make them solvent again. And it was just a nasty, nasty event. That was a terrible time. And that was when Bitcoin's first took off. And now we're seeing another boom. I mean, it was $15 at the beginning of this year. Now, last I checked, it was like 87, I think, this morning. And, you know, it's being boosted by the Cyprus situation where people frantically converting their euros to Bitcoin. And, you know, it's funny. People talk about Bitcoin, and people, I encounter people all the time that are trying to debunk it. And my first question is, well, have you ever actually owned any and played with them? And they always say no. And so I can kind of get why a person would be skeptical of it. You know, if you're not that familiar with the way digital economics works, if you're not that familiar with the way ones and zeros are the are real commodity of value today, and you've never played with them, then, yeah, you kind of debunk them. But it's the second you actually own them and start trading them, and you see just what an amazing payment system it really is, then you begin to change your mind. I was on a Skype call the other day, and I had the guy download the blockchain app, remember his password, and hold up his QR code to the camera while we were on Skype. I just quickly scanned his QR code and sent him half a Bitcoin. Like, and he felt his phone buzz, and he looked at me and went, oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not sure. Like, if I had to be, you know, I don't know, Walter Block or somebody and figure out exactly the definition, if it's more like gold or if it's more like paper fiat money or whatever. But, in fact, I can see how it's always going to have value, assuming that the government can't find a way to just crack it and regulate it and throw you in jail for it or something like that.
Yeah.
It seems like there is certainly value in having anonymous, encryptable digital money. And so it's not quote-unquote intrinsic value, but sort of.
Right.
Right? It's never going to go down to zero.
Yeah. And here's the thing, too. I mean, the fact that you have really assigned titles to these Bitcoins makes all the difference. That's what I think people don't really understand. It's not as if I can just sit at home and make up a Bitcoin, you know. I mean, you really have to mine them. And then what you mine has to pass through, you know, the Bitcoin community and get approved as an actual Bitcoin. And then it's purchased and it's really owned by somebody. And it appears in the ledger, and the ledger is public information. And it's downloaded every time you do any transactions with it. So you solve that problem, and then you approach the realm of soundness, really. And, you know, It's funny. I've had other people tell me, well, I'll never use a currency I don't understand. Well, you know, we use things we don't understand all the time. I mean, I don't understand how the heck a smartphone works, but I use it, you know, every, you know, all day.
Yeah, well, there's a certain level of understanding depending on your level of expertise about computer code and stuff like that. But just think about how everybody uses dollars just on the premise that George Washington's on the damn thing, and that means it must be legit, you know?
It's basically all we know. What's funny about Bitcoin is there's a built-in skepticism towards government paper. And I tell you, it's very interesting, Scott. I've gone through this psychological change as I started using Bitcoin. If I use it several times in the course of a day to do something, whether buying or selling or trading or giving or, you know, whatever, then I find myself sort of weirdly annoyed, you know, that when I get in a cab and the guy wants dollars, I think, what the heck kind of, you know, analog man are you?
Yeah, dollars, really? That's funny. You're way ahead of the curve, man. You're way the right end of the bell curve on a lot of things happening. There's no doubt about that. And you know what? Man, I'm so sorry we're out of time because Trita Parsi's coming on. We got to talk about Iran sanctions and stuff like this. But I still have more things I wanted to talk with you about. This would probably be better for just kind of a off-the-air, shooting the S sort of conversation anyway. But I wanted to talk with you. I had a brief conversation with Anthony Gregory yesterday about the economics of skateboarding and the cutthroat competition in pro skateboarders' video parts and how it has pushed skateboarding, which it happens to be the thing I love, it just, you know, way past light speed. It advances so fast. And it's because of the economics of the whole situation, you know what I mean? The cutthroat competition nature.
That sounds like my kind of article. I really get into these sort of micro sectors of dynamic economics like that, where you see how the economy really interacts with real human beings doing cool stuff. I mean, it's so magical and interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And you know, the funny silver lining, weird, ironic part of that too is that it's all the inflation in the housing market over the last generation or so, or, well, 10 years, 12 years especially, that has led to the creation of these thousands of new concrete skate parks all over the country because of all that excess tax revenue coming in, property tax revenue coming into the municipalities and county governments and stuff. And so, like, really, Alan Greenspan is the best thing that ever happened to skateboarding by far.
That's very interesting. Yeah. I had no clue about this.
And they're made of concrete, so they're not going anywhere. I mean, they're on government land, and they're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So
that sounds like a wonderful article. Maybe I'll have to look into that a little bit. Every time you start investigating these little sectors, you know, it gets so fascinating. You know, it's like you're just sort of crawling down this rabbit hole, you know, further and further. And it's a beautiful thing to observe the way the market works. You know, it's just infinitely complex and nowadays globalized and the information streams. And it's just a beautiful thing to see human needs being met by other human beings, you know, through this lovely system.
Yep, it is. It's really cool. I fear that everybody starts tuning out once I start talking about skateboard, but I'm trying to keep it Austrian, you know. All right. I got to go. Thank you so much for your time, Jeffrey. You're great.
Really great to be here, Scott, and good to catch up.
All right, everybody, that is the great Jeffrey Tucker. He's at Laissez Faire Books. That's LFB.org. LFB.org. And here's a great article, Top Alternatives to Paper Money. His coverage of the Bitcoin thing and some other good stuff, too. Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. At government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. CNI stands against America's negative role in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war party's relentless push to bomb Iran, and the roles played by twisted Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia in justifying it all. The Council for the National Interest works tirelessly to expose and oppose our government's most destructive policies, but they can't do it without you. Support CNI's push to straighten out America's crooked course. Check out the Council for the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page. That's CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of FFF.org. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writer MichaelSwanson.com for more details.